9:08 now on this Wednesday morning, and I got a text earlier from somebody that said, I'm a regular listener to WWL. WWL is a massive listening audience, well-respected media outlet in southern Louisiana. Big, beautiful Bill is going to hammer the crap out of hundreds of thousands of Louisiana citizens. I would hope that WWL would denounce those senators and representatives who supported this dreadful bill. And if anyone wants to pretend that this wasn't passed for the rich, then they have buried their heads in the sand. There's no justification at all. Thank you. Well, thank you for texting in. But to be fair to us, we have looked at all different sides of the big, beautiful bill and who it's going to hurt and who it's going to help. I started at 6 o'clock talking with a professor of political science at Hamline University and recounted the story of my neighbor, who is on Social Security and was strictly against the big, beautiful bill because of it increasing the debt and deficit until he realized that there was no taxes on Social Security. And at that point, he did a flip-flop and said he was 100% for it. So I guess in a lot of ways, sometimes it depends on who does it help and who does it hurt. Sometimes people, though, don't know what helps them and what hurts them. With that in mind, Walter Dublane joins us, an associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO, to talk about Medicaid cuts in the big, beautiful bill and what that means. Good morning, Dub. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Connor.
I'm sure this is pretty simple stuff we're going to go through, right?
Yeah, not quite.
So let's.
I mean, this is a fairly complicated issue.
So I don't know how you're a professor. You tell me the best way to present the material, Dub. I'm gonna let you create the syllabus. Is it? Do we start with who gets Medicaid and who's dependent on it, and who this could hurt and what the cuts could mean? You take it.
Well, again, especially in Louisiana, because under Governor Edwards, we did do the Medicaid rollout that increased the number of people we have. A greater percentage of Louisiana people on Medicaid than any other state in the union.
Let me slow down for a second, Dub. When you say Medicaid rollout and it increased the number of people on Medicaid, what did that result in? Did that mean that people that could have afforded insurance, that could have had their own insurance, decided to lay on the leg of the taxpayers with Medicaid? Does it mean that people that didn't have insurance or didn't have medical care before got it? Tell me what that meant.
The answer is yes and yes.
Okay.
That most of the people that got it, what happened was this was a part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, mm-hmm. that they were, the purpose of Obamacare was to, the main purpose was to get more people on insurance, and it did it two ways. One, by basically saying anybody that is up to 138% of the federal poverty line, and for a family of four, that's around $35,000 now. Anybody that's has an income in that range will automatically be qualified for Medicaid. Under the old rules in Louisiana, pretty much the only people that were on Medicaid were very, very poor people below the poverty line, and mostly had to be women with dependent children. That was about the only people on Medicaid. So once they did the Medicaid rollout through Obamacare, that increased by about 500,000 people. The people that got onto Medicaid in Louisiana. Now,
okay.
Some of those people were working for companies where they had insurance and they dropped their insurance and did it. But I think the numbers I've seen on that are only about 10%, whatever. There was an effect of some people that actually did it, but the vast majority had no insurance and now have it.
So what happened to that vast majority before the Medicaid expansion? What were they doing for medical care before? And now what's going to happen after the big, beautiful bill? Because in between, they had Medicaid, right?
Right. They had Medicaid. And again, the estimates that I've seen in Louisiana is about 120,000, maybe as much as twice as that, will probably lose their Medicaid. Interestingly enough, not completely because of the cuts, but because of the work requirement. Because it turns out the vast majority of people on Medicaid, there are exceptions to that. Would qualify for Medicaid under the new rules. The problem is you have to document it. So you have to be working at least, 80 hours a month. And but the problem is to be able to document it, you've got to have pay stubs, or if you're an Uber driver, you can prove that you're how many hours you're working. And many of these people can't come up with the documentation. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're not meeting the criteria, mm-hmm. but this interesting thing to notice, Arkansas did this a couple of years ago. The same thing that the federal government's doing now. And what they found out is a lot of people lost their Medicaid. And when they went back in and researched them, they found out most of them actually qualified for Medicaid, but they just couldn't prove it. And so it ended. And furthermore, the whole worst part of that was in Arkansas, at least the people that studied it, you know, the whole purpose was to get some of the people that could be, that should be working back working. There was no increase in employment due to this rule in Arkansas. So it's one of those things that sounds good when you say it. Yes, we want these people who are able-bodied people to be able to work, because there are exceptions. You know, women taking care of little children, they're not required to meet this, or taking care of elderly patients or the infirm, things of that sort. There's lots of exceptions. But they're saying, well, you got able-bodied people that aren't working. Well, there turns out there aren't very many of those. Mm-hmm. So this idea of sounds really good, but in practice it doesn't seem to be working the way it's supposed to. So again, so those people, back to the original question, if they don't have Medicaid, what do? The answer is mostly they don't get much in the way of care, except for there are free clinics around, federally qualified health institutions that treat them, and they go to the emergency room. Now it turns out, but now that they have Medicaid, many of them are able to go to primary care physicians and get more routine care. And this is really a big deal, because if they don't have any care at all, they go to the emergency room. When they do get sick, they often are very sick, and fixing them up is much harder to do. So that's probably where we're going to, there may be a large number in Louisiana, say estimates up to 120,000 or more that might be having insurance right now under Medicaid, and then they won't have it.
Okay, so at what time, what's the time frame on all of that? Do you have any idea yet? Does this bill specify that, or do you know?
Actually, that's a good question. I mean, of course, now it hasn't, remember, we still
it hasn't
have
passed
to,
yeah,
it's
right,
got to go
yeah.
back to the House.
Yeah,
it's got to go back to the House, but the House is going to pass something. We're pretty sure that's all this. And the Senate bill is much harder on Medicaid than the House bill was. I don't know. I don't know that actually the implementation deadline.
I guess,
I'm sure it takes a couple of months. But part of the problem is now all the Medicaid officials have to be trained in how to do all of these work requirement type of things. Right now we don't have anybody checking that. Now to check it is going to be a real problem.
So the idea behind the work requirement was to make sure that, because they're getting Medicaid anyway, I don't understand how working helps decrease the amount of Medicaid that they receive, does it?
They may be working now on Medicaid, but maybe they'll move up, you know, in the company to a point where they don't need Medicaid anymore. That's kind of the philosophy behind the people able to work first should be working, and then secondly, hopefully some of them will work their way out off of Medicaid.
That's what I was trying to figure out, what the reason was there, because the same people would still be getting Medicaid. They'd just be working, right? Unless you didn't work,
again,
then you wouldn't get Medicaid.
Like you say, all the evidence we've seen is the vast majority of people that are on Medicaid are working. They just in very low-paying jobs that don't provide, or, you know, part-time jobs or gig work or things like that don't provide insurance. And so they don't buy it. And this is how but they're also low enough income that they qualify for Medicaid, at least under the Obamacare rules.
So that's from the demand side. What about from the supply side? How would that affect health care in Louisiana?
Well, again, this is the other big problem is, again, I was talking to people at hospitals that are saying they're now trying to figure out what services they're going to cut when this goes through, knowing that the hospitals are going to be losing income, because right now they don't get much off of, especially rural hospitals. Let's talk about rural hospitals. That's the big ones. Rural hospitals actually get paid fairly good for Medicaid patients, as opposed to the community hospitals who get paid very poorly. But if all those same patients that they're now getting paid for all of a sudden don't have insurance anymore, they'll still be going to the hospital, but now they will be uninsured patients, and therefore the income of the rural hospitals are going to be going down. And the rural hospitals operate right now on very thin margins to begin with. So there's a prediction that there may be hundreds of hospitals across the country. I've heard estimates as many as 20 or 30 in the state of Louisiana that might close because of this.
So,
and then you've got health care issues with everybody in those rural parishes.
So I'm not trying to be stupid here. How are we defining a rural hospital?
actually, I don't know the actual definition, but it's usually, these are mostly hospitals like have like 25 beds, mm-hmm. you know, that type of thing. And just of course located in, they're not in major cities or stuff, but it's really small hospitals.
So
is what you're talking about.
When they if they close, that means the people that were dependent on them do what?
Well, they drive a lot farther to get to another mm-hmm. hospital. And if you've got to drive right now, you're driving, 15 or 20 minutes to get to the hospital. Now you have to drive over an hour to get to the hospital. Some people won't go as often. And even if they do, for certain types of things, time is important getting to the hospital. So there will probably, and again, it's not just the ones that are now uninsured, but it's everybody else that uses those hospitals now won't have a hospital.
Somebody texted in and said, I thought part of the issue on Medicaid was that over 7 million men were on Medicaid rolls and the U.S. government was picking 90% of the cost. Many of those men were able to work and were not. Do you have any idea if that's true or not?
I haven't seen evidence of that. Okay. I mean, what I've seen says that there's not nearly that many that fit that category.
And again, whenever you start talking about politics and people making up this, making up that, who knows where the truth is. Somebody wants to know about seniors and disabled in nursing homes. Does this have anything to do with any of that?
Well, yes, because most people in nursing homes, I mean, almost half the people in nursing homes are there on Medicaid. And so I've seen some, I've been looking a little bit into how it affects Medicaid. This has to do with the other part of it, which is called the provider fees. I can say this really gets complicated.
But that's all right. That's where the trouble is in the details. Go ahead.
that hospitals right now in Louisiana and most other states basically give fees to the state Department of Health, who uses that money to get Medicaid match, because for some patients, Medicaid pays $9 for every dollar we do. So if the hospitals give them $1 million, that turns into $10 million, and which then gets sent back to the hospitals and support them. Now they've cut the Medicaid provider fees. Right now it's, over the next 5 or 6 years, that those fees are going to be cut in half of how much they can give. And so that will lower the total amount of money in the Medicaid budget for the state, which will then affect everybody. Now, the nursing homes are in a slightly different category. Their provider fees have not been cut. So they won't be affected as much by that. But the nursing homes will be affected by this because, again, for many of them, half of their patients are Medicaid patients.
So let me take a break. We're going to pick it up here specifically when it comes to because I'm getting a lot of text on nursing homes and Medicaid, and we can talk about the spending down requirements and so forth and if any of that changes or not. Dublane's our guest, Walter Dublane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. Every action has a reaction. We're talking about what? The big, beautiful bill, which has not passed yet, but has gone back to the House and is now in conference and ultimately will, in one way or the other, you would think, reach the president's desk and be signed. What that'll mean for the healthcare delivery system in Louisiana. You got any questions or comments? 504-260-1870. Don't text and drive. And I'll pass those questions along when we come back on WWL. All right, here's back with Walter Dublane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO. Let me clean this up because I said no taxes on Social Security. First of all, no bill has been passed or signed yet. Secondly, I was going by what my neighbor told me. That was based on a conversation of picking up the garbage cans. He was going by what President Trump said. It's like a game of telephone, which is no taxes on Social Security. However, the Senate proposal includes a temporary $6,000 deduction for seniors over the age of 65. The House proposal, a temporary deduction of $4,000. But it's not, as President Trump said, no tax on Social Security. So I just wanted to clean that up.
Yep.
Okay, Lau. Let's move on to nursing homes with what's going on with spending down, what Medicaid pays for. I don't think people that haven't been there yet with parents or whatever understand exactly how important Medicaid is to the nursing home industry. Thoughts?
Well, again, first of all, just to remember that Medicare doesn't pay for what we consider traditional nursing home care. Mm-hmm. Medicare only pays for what's called convalescent care. If you've been in the hospital and you need to go to the nursing home for a month or so to recover, Medicare pays for that, but they don't pay for long-term care for things like Alzheimer's and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, most people think of seniors getting their aid through Medicare. That doesn't cover most nursing home care. So there's two ways we're paying for it. You pay for it out of the pocket. We're talking about $80,000 a year, many times for nursing home care. That pretty much drains most people's pockets pretty quickly. Or to qualify for Medicaid, you've got to be poor. And poor includes not only your income, but also your savings. That's where you come up with the spend-down rule. That there's a rule that says you have to pay for the nursing home yourself until you spend enough of your savings so that you're now qualified for Medicaid to take over. That's the spend-down rule.
Different when it comes to assets, when it comes to a house, I believe there is a provision if there is a surviving spouse, yeah. A surviving spouse can keep the house?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a number of restrictions to that in general. In particular, one, if you have a surviving spouse, then that affects how much you have to spend down. And certainly the house is protected.
Unless it's there is no surviving spouse, then, and now we're getting into usufruct and everything else here, but then you have to divest yourself of that house. Is it 3 or 4 years before you anticipate going into a nursing home so it doesn't count against you?
Yeah, that's called the look back rule.
Okay.
The other thing you can't do is knowing you're coming up to that and start giving $50,000 to each of your three kids, right before you try to qualify. They look back at what you're at what you've done in terms of your assets, but in particular that. So you can't do that.
Which means
give your money away so now you qualify.
And then that leads people to think, and I'm just being practical here, some people want their parents to sign the house over to them so it stays in the estate like 3 or 4 years, maybe if they're anticipating a nursing home down the line, which they can do, I believe, but a lot of parents are hesitant to do that, right?
Yeah, and again, I don't know the exact rules and all that. I just know the general principles involved.
So with that being said, does this bill affect any of that, Dub, as far as you know?
I don't think it affects that. This is all just about the two main principles that were affecting Medicaid were this work. There's a total cut in Medicaid funding. There's also, but the biggest cut has to do with what we anticipate happening with this work requirements. And then the other one are these provider fee rules. Those are the main characteristics that affect Medicaid, as I understand it.
So to try to simplify this a little bit, we're talking about a pool of how many people, again, depending on what version of the bill goes through, approximately how many people in Louisiana will be tossed off of the Medicaid rolls, and if so, what do they do?
Again, the estimates I've seen start at about 120,000, maybe up to twice as much of that. And again, they will then become, unless they, if they get tossed off and then they can go back and prove, yes, they are working and then get back on. Mm-hmm. And because I can say a lot of them do qualify, they just can't prove it, or they haven't been able to prove it. So again, they become uninsured. If they become uninsured, they either have to go to free clinics or they go to the emergency room for most of their care.
How does this relate to Obamacare at all, or the health care delivery system in the nation with affordable health care? Does that affect this at all?
Well, I mean, again, it affects Obamacare because in Louisiana, we took advantage of the Obamacare rollout. Governor Edwards did, and that increased the number of people in Louisiana. We have about 1.5 million people, 30% of our total population on Medicare right now. We've cut back a little bit because, how do we get it? There was a big expansion during the pandemic, and we cut back a number of people that no longer qualified under those rules. But still, we have we're expected of 1.5 million. They're talking about maybe 100,000, a little bit more, that might lose their Medicaid.
And let me go a step back. The money for Medicaid comes from where?
Well, again, there's two buckets. The traditional Medicaid, which is people that qualified under the old rules before Obamacare. In Louisiana, the federal government pays about two-thirds of the expense, and the state pays one-third. In other words, for every dollar the state pays, Medicaid pays two more from the federal government. for the newly qualified people under the 500,000 that are qualified under the new Obamacare rules, the federal government pays for 90% of those people. So for every dollar that the state pays, the federal government kicks in $9. Now, that's about a third of our population that meets the new rules. Two-thirds were still under the old rules.
Mm-hmm. So if you had to predict, and I know you've been involved with hospitals and you study this for your life's work, what the result of this Medicaid contraction, if I can call it that, would be on the state, it would be what?
Well, again, you're going to have people that are losing their insurance, okay? And if they lose their insurance, we pretty much can we've got some documents, their health care will go down. They won't be able to be getting the routine types of visits. And so the biggest effect is on the people that are losing their health insurance. But the other effect is on the providers, that hospitals are now trying to figure out. I wouldn't say this is a likely one, but for instance, a hospital might decide that they're no longer going to deliver babies because it turns out labor and delivery has a high Medicaid component to it. Mm-hmm. And so we say, well, since we're losing money on that anyway, now we're going to lose more money. I won't do that anymore. So hospitals might be cutting certain services that are heavily Medicaid dependent. Other hospitals, the biggest worry though is the hospitals that are closing, particularly these rural hospitals where you might have 40 or 50% of their population are on Medicaid.
And my concern is you can only shove so much stuff into a pipe. And with that analogy being said, if people aren't getting the preventative care that they need through Medicare, they're going to wind up going to hospitals in emergency rooms. And as a result, that gets passed on to us or not?
Yes. In some ways, it's very indirect. What's traditionally happened is that the people that have insurance end up paying a little bit more in order to keep the hospitals open, because Blue Cross can't insure people if the hospitals close. And so they kind of subsidize that, but their subsidy comes through our higher insurance premiums for everybody that has insurance.
Is this analogous to putting a Band-Aid on the healthcare system, delivery system in a country?
Well, I think it's more like ripping off one.
Okay.
So,
ripping off the Band-Aid, not putting one on, and you still got the gaping wound.
Yeah,
thank you.
Because then Medicaid's kind of a Band-Aid to begin with, and now you're ripping it off. Now you're you have an open sore.
Thank you, Dub. Appreciate your time, as always, and your expertise. Walter Dub Land, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. It's complicated. Nobody wants waste. Nobody wants anything for free. But again, there's only so much stuff you can shove into a tube, and at some point, it's going to come squirting out, and the question is, who winds up paying for it when it comes squirting out? That's a layman's example of that. 9:37, we'll talk to NOPD about ankle monitoring when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:44, 16 till 10. We welcome in Lieutenant Andrew Waldron of the NOPD Homicide Unit. But, Lieutenant, I got to warn you, we got some kind of breaking news with P. Diddy or something. I'll probably have to interrupt you at one point around 50 and then come back to you, okay?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you. It's good to talk to you, and I appreciate all the work you do. Let's talk about Leroy Johnson, I think, is the guy's name. I just want to get the truth out there, because we talked to Matt Dennis with ASAP, and he said one thing, and I know you guys have a different angle on it, or a different view of it. Tell me the story, or at least tell me about Leroy Johnson, ankle monitoring, and so forth. Lieutenant, I'll let you have the floor.
Yes, sir. First of all, I just want to say that, we have great success with our investigations, and it's through our collaboration with our partners, whether it be in the private sector or with the state, federal, and local partners. ASAP is a very pivotal partner with us. We've worked with them. We need them, and they need us. And so there's been a little bit of confusion. I'm not going to go tit for tat here. But, mm-hmm. From the homicide perspective, Deputy Aples was killed early Sunday morning on the 22nd. We were able to get some surveillance footage on Monday, the next day, the 23rd, and we were able to see that the person of interest had an ankle monitor on their leg. I've had Miss Jill Dennis come to my units and train us, and we have access to OmniLink, which is the geolocation service, which allows us to put in locations and see if there are any offenders being monitored in that location. Mm-hmm. That is a common practice for both the homicide division and for all the other investigative units. Anytime we have an armed robbery, a shooting, a murder, it's common practice that we run a proximity report. And what that means is we put in the location. In this case, it was at the intersection, near the intersection of Morrison and Downman. We put that location into, at the time, what we thought was their only system. And it's the only system we have access to, the devices themselves, into the OmniLink system. We didn't get any hits from the proximity report, which would put the subject on the scene.
Let me slow down a little bit, Lieutenant. I'm trying to keep track of this. So you saw the video. He was wearing an ankle monitor, right?
That's right, sir.
And then from there, what happened?
So it's common practice, whether we have that video or not, for every case we investigate, we run a geolocation proximity report via OmniLink, which is a system ASAP has given us access to and has trained us on.
So if it's at Canal and Broad Street or whatever it is, I don't know, pick a street. If it's there, then if that's where the incident occurs, then you go to this proximity locator to see if anybody is under a monitor in that area. I got that right?
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. We would put in maybe 500 or 1,000 feet circumference.
I got you.
And it would give you locations and how many times it's hit at what times. So we were kind of stumped, to be honest. There's a couple other providers in the area. We reached out to them on Monday, and we didn't get anything back as to if it would be them. As a testament to our working relationship with ASAP, on Tuesday, we emailed them and said, hey, we're kind of stumped here. Do you have any advice on, you know, who might be monitoring this device? Because at this point, we didn't know who this subject was. If we knew who he was, obviously we would have approached it a little differently, but we didn't know who he was. Mm-hmm. And ASAP responded to us later with a screenshot, which included Jeroy Johnson's information and the pings from his ankle monitor, which put him on the scene corroborating the video surveillance footage. Mm-hmm. What was interesting, though, is the screenshot was of a system none of us had ever seen. So that's when we called ASAP directly. We have good working relationships, like I said, and I want to keep them that way. Mm-hmm. And they informed us that there was a separate system called the TRAC system, where they had 121 of their most violent offenders on this system, but we don't have access to it. None of us had ever heard of it at this point. Which was very surprising, to be honest, because we do have a very transparent relationship, and it's a relationship that I want to keep, and I want to keep fostering, because whatever collaborative effects that we have together to make investigations stronger and quicker to bring justice to families, that's our goal. So once we found this information out, we were told that we have to come to ASAP, and we confirmed that Jeroy Johnson was on the scene of this murder. And this was him in this video. I myself personally went to ASAP and met with their employees and confirmed this information with my own eyes. I immediately contacted our violent offender warrant squad and the U.S. Marshals. And within 2 hours of me getting to their location, he was in custody. He had seen himself on the news that day and had fled. He fled to Slidell and was kind of hiding out in a wooded area and kind of picked up on law enforcement and tried to flee. He was arrested without incident. Again, within 2 hours, once we learned of this system. Now, ASAP had talked. Do you get to a break, sir?
I do, Lieutenant. Tell you, you're savvy, man. I'm telling you, you're listening to music and you know. So let's pick it up there when we come back, all right? And also, I want to know, with going forward, is NOPD going to have access to that second monitoring system track? And I got a couple of other questions as well. We're talking about the identification of Jeroy Johnson, who is charged with killing that Jefferson Parish Sheriff's officer. And we're talking to Lieutenant Andrew Walden with the Homicide Unit. We'll get back to him in a second. But first, we pause for some breaking news here from CBS about the P. Diddy verdict. And then we'll be back here on WWL. All right, Lieutenant, apparently we're on a different tracking system as well. So tell me about now, where were you when you interrupted yourself? I'm sorry about that.
So again, this is a system that we don't have access to. We weren't even aware that it existed, and which is, it's odd, honestly, because, again, we do have a great working relationship with ASAP. Ms. Jill Dennis has my number. We speak regularly regarding a whole number of issues. And to learn that 121 of the most violent individuals that they monitor on that was kind of disturbing, to be honest. To hear Mr. Dennis again last night or on your show talk about how we can't have access because of the law, and then he said our policy restricts us. You know, again, I'm looking.
So what is the key, Lieutenant, to having access to track? Is it proprietary, or is it something that NOPD would have to pay for?
Sure.
Something.
I do know that the system that we do have access to, which until last week we were under the impression it was the only system ASAP used. Mm-hmm. We can run a geolocation report and only have access to that information, then we have to request that they open up the individual who's being monitored to us after we locate them in the geolocation report. From my understanding is that the other system may not be able to be restricted to that. It would just be wide open access. So we need to work together to find a common ground here where, you know, maybe one or two people might have access to it because we can't run a geolocation report. And my concern is that, you know, they have 121 individuals who are their most violent offenders on this system. Mm-hmm. Maybe we've missed some in the past because we didn't know it existed before last week. So again, you know, immediately upon finding this out, we've worked with Ms. Jill Dennis to try and set up training with NOPD in the coming weeks to train on their database that they have. And they're very, they push that a lot. And look, it's no secret here that they are a for-profit business. They have a product that they offer. It's very good. They have a very good product. They're not the only ankle monitoring service in this area, but they're one of the largest. And they're pushing for legislation that all individuals who are on ankle monitors have to be registered in some database. And conveniently, it's a database they have already established. And if that's the way that this goes, so be it. I mean, that's business. And I'm not knocking them for that. But we need to know which systems that they have in place for us to be able to run geolocation reports for individuals for when these violent crimes happen. There's no reason in today's age that someone should be monitored by an ankle monitor and the police cannot run a geolocation report and find out who it is.
Lieutenant, let me jump in here.
We don't have the video surveillance. We don't see that this individual has a monitor on his leg.
To begin with, right. You know, let me just ask you this, just from a layman's standpoint. You know, people are wondering about, you know, location report, and that's all after the fact. Is there any way that NOPD or anybody could actively, is there not the manpower for that, to monitor if somebody violates their probation, go pick them up before they kill somebody, or is that not possible?
Well, we would have to know of that. I mean, that's, and I think that's a lot of these things that we have to work forward through. The only way we have access, we have geolocation access. So current, you know, if something happens outside, like you said earlier, Broad and Canal, we would run Broad and Canal and then it would tell us. ASAP has the ability to look at all individuals live. We don't. Uh-huh. And I think that's the problem with their other system that they're using. And now they're using multiple systems, is that they can't restrict the access to that system.
Thank you, Lieutenant. I appreciate your time. You're welcome anytime. Lieutenant Andrew Waldron, Homicide Unit, NOPD. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.